Thank you very much. Is the microphone on? Okay, thank you. So I'd like to thank the organizers for the kind invitation. The idea for this talk, in a sense, arose a year and a half ago at a southern incarnation of this series of meetings in Brisbane, where Jay Olson was telling about his work with Tim Ralph on time-like entanglement in the Unruh effect, in a certain somewhat generalized setting from what we usually see. And that talk rang a lot of bells with me, and I was reminded that there is, in fact, a version of the Unruh effect in which there are time-like correlations in a setting that I will argue is an entirely uncontroversial one, arguably even everyday one in a certain sense. And the simplest example of that is an accelerated observer in Minkowski half space. There are gravitational versions thereof, and I have been working on this topic for some time. Here are the collaborators with David Bruski is here, and Rob Mann is here. So I would like to take this opportunity to tell about the time-like correlations that do arise in the Unruh effect. So I'll first get started with recalling how the Unruh effect works in the entirely conventional setting of Rindler space. Now, I do realize that this is familiar to most and perhaps even all of the audience. But I'd like to make certain points about the standard setting of the Unruh effect. In particular, I'd like to say that there is a sense in which correlations between early time and late time occur already in the entirely ordinary Unruh effect. They are not useful correlations for most purposes, and there are good reasons why you don't hear of them, but nevertheless, they are there. And once we understand why they are there, it will be very straightforward to go on to Rindler half space, Minkowski space with a mirror, and see that there are time-like correlations that are relevant even for a single accelerated observer. And so that's basically the first half of the talk. Then I'll show that there are similar settings in the gravitational context as well. There are time-like correlations in certain versions of black holes, and there are keywords that go with them, and I'll explain those keywords as we go along. And then I'll summarize. Now, what got me interested in this topic is the quantum field theory in curved space-time context, and it was only at this Brisbane meeting that the idea came to me that there might be something here in these time-like correlations that could be used for quantum information. I don't have anything concrete to say about that, but I would like to present this suggestion. Should it turn out that these correlations can be used in quantum information protocols, I would be delighted indeed. So that's the plan of the talk. Any urgent questions at this point? Okay. So, for most of the talk, I'll be in Minkowski space, I'll even be in 1 plus 1 Minkowski space, and for concreteness, let's think of a scalar field, might be massive or massless. That's the concrete setting. And recall that when we are in Minkowski space has lots of symmetry. It has Poincaré symmetry, and that Poincaré symmetry is built into our usual way of defining quantum field theory, the usual notion of particles. We use the time translation invariance, and the time translational invariance is related to an observer. In fact, if we think of the time translation invariance along the world line of this particular inertial observer Bob here, we are actually thinking of a whole family of Bobs that move the same velocity, and we define positive and negative frequencies with respect to that time translation symmetry. Okay. Now, a particle has, of course, a momentum, and the momentum depends on who is looking at it, what your velocity is with respect to the particle. But in Minkowski space quantum field theory, there is this distinguished state, the no-particle state, the vacuum, which is Poincaré invariant, it has no particles no matter which inertial observer is looking at it. So in this setting, we use the Poincaré invariance in an essential way. And so this was essentially the state of the art until mid-1970s. And then there was this discovery by Unruh that if you take a uniformly accelerated observer, well, if we are in 1 plus 1 Minkowski space, we can that's enough to say everything. We could say uniformly linearly accelerated observer. They see the Minkowski vacuum as a thermal state in a temperature proportional to the acceleration. And here's the acceleration. The world line is a hyperbola in this global Minkowski coordinates. So there are some idealizations that make into this that go into this observation. So for example, this is a small coupling effect. We are neglecting the back reaction between whoever measures the field and the vacuum there. And there are issues about switching the detector on and off. But provided those issues are under control, we work in the weak coupling regime, we handle the switching appropriately, then the prediction arises that this uniformly accelerated observer sees the vacuum as a thermal state. And there are different ways to look at it. One is by looking at particle detectors, and we've heard about those in the earlier talks. Now, what I'd like to concentrate on is the way of looking at this from the point of view of positive and negative frequencies associated with this accelerated observer rob. And recall the setting, right? So there is our one uniformly accelerated observer. And the idea is that we don't think of this as a single observer. We think of it as belonging to a family. Family who are dragged along a sense of time evolution. But the time evolution is not that of Minkowski time translations. It is time translations as generated by a boost. All of these trajectories are the orbits of a single boost vector, a boost killing vector, if we like to use that language. These are dragged by a boost. And Rob is there one among that family. And Minkowski space has boost symmetry. And as long as these world lines here are time-like, you can use that boost symmetry to define the notion of a particle. And that is how we define the notion of a particle that Rob sees over here. Those particles are labeled by a frequency type label. It's not a Minkowski time translation frequency. It is a frequency type parameter associated with the relevant time translation here. But it is a parameter, nevertheless, that we can use to label the states. So how does the thermality arise from here? So the basic observation is that you don't just have one wedge of Minkowski space where this time translation killing vector is time-like. There is a second wedge, a causally disconnected wedge. And there is a similar sense of time translation as defined by boosts. And once we use that definition of particles in the right and left, the basic calculation is, what does Minkowski space look like? So there is the frequency label that labels the relevant rob frequencies. There are technical subtleties in what this product means. And in fact, strictly technically, it doesn't mean anything. These theories are unitarily inequivalent. But let me not get into that. So the basic computation is that for each frequency, the Minkowski vacuum is a superposition of particles seen by the robs on the left, over there, and robs on the right, over there. And there are certain specific weights that come into this superposition. And this state in quantum optics is known as a two-mode squeezed state. And why this gives thermality? Well, if we are looking at a rob here on the right, then rob on the right is causally disconnected from all the robs on the left. And what remains is a density matrix, and it is Planckian in the Unruh temperature. So this is the conventional way to view the Unruh effect in the language of these Bogoliubov transformations. So up to this point, entirely standard. There's one point I'd like to make about this. So we've used the notion of particle is based on plane wave type states. Plane wave type states of Rob, labeled by this entirely sharp frequency conjugate to the boost time. Okay? So the states that occur in this, they are non-localized plane waves. These particles here, particles of Rob, particles of the Rob on the left, they are plane waves. They are entirely unlocalized in time. So the way you write this formula, you don't see any sense of time localization in it at all. So this question I'd like to pose is, well, you don't see time correlations there. Are there, in fact, some? And there are. To see them, you need to use not these entirely unlocalized plane wave states, but wave packets that are localized in space-time and in frequency. So let's go through a similar calculation in terms of wave packets and see what is similar, what is different. Okay. So there's the same Minkowski space, the same quadrant on the right, the same quadrant on the left. But I'd like to do these particles adapted to the boost symmetry here and the boost symmetry here in terms of wave packets, localized wave packets. Well, as we've heard in this meeting, localization is a rather tricky subject. Okay. That there are standard ways to form wave packets, and the calculations we did were based on some standard setting. But I would like to emphasize that for what I'm about to say, the precise sense of localization is completely irrelevant. What follows is an isometry argument. So when I say pick localized wave packets, take your favorite sense of localization. All I'm asking that it is in some approximate sense localized in this frequency conjugate to the boost time and in the relevant sense in location. But the precise sense, feel free to pick that at your leisure. So we'd like to do a similar calculation here. What does the Minkowski space vacuum, Minkowski vacuum look like when written in terms of these wave packet type particles? Well, there are some things that are obvious. Well, if the plane wave states gave correlations between the right and between the left, the wave packet states must again give correlations between the right and the left. So we must get something of this form. J is now the label that labels the wave packets. We must get a wave packet on the right correlated with a wave packet on the left. Okay? And those coefficients there, well, the details of them will depend on your construction of the wave packets. But as long as I have this approximate localization in the frequency, they will approximately look like this. So this much is obvious. Okay. What's perhaps not so obvious, and what is in fact the key point of this talk, is what's the sense of time correlations here? These packets are now localized in time and space. How are they localized in this picture? Well, by symmetry, there ought to be one pair that's localized in some fashion like this. So if I pick a right-hand side particle that is localized over there, then its correlated pair should be localized there on the left in this Minkowski frame that I've chosen. So, okay, so this is at time zero in my chosen time. This is at time zero at my chosen time. What happens if I want to look at a particle here that's localized, say, to the far future? What's happening to this particle on the left? So I guess we could have a quiz here to see who is awake at this hour. So if this particle is instead localized in the far future, so what happens to this? Is it localized over there, or is it localized there, or might it possibly stay someplace over there? Well, the key is Minkowski vacuum is boost invariant. If I move this particle to the far future, It happens by doing a boost on this whole picture, and a boost that takes me to the future on the left will take me to the future on the right, will take me to the past on the left. If I take a particle on the right that's localized to the future, its correlated pair will be localized. So if it's in the future on the right, then it's in the past on the left. And this does not depend on the precise sense of localization. This is a pure isometry argument. So there are correlations in time here, in the sense that a late time particle on the right is correlated with an early time particle on the left, and vice versa. Okay. Now, why don't you hear of this usually? If you're just interested in the observations that this one Rindler-Robb does here on the right, these particles on the left are still space-like separated. For Robb's purposes, it doesn't matter whether this particle is in the past, whether it's in the future. You trace over it, and Robb's observations can't tell the difference. Should you be working with multiple detectors, say you might have one detector moving over here and another detector moving over here, and perhaps they come later into contact someplace over here, then with such detectors you could start seeing the significance of these correlations between early and late, and we've heard about such detectors earlier in this meeting. But if you're interested in a single Robb, it doesn't matter for that single Robb whether those correlations are in the future or in the past. They are space-like separated. So you don't usually hear of these correlations between early times and late times, and for a good reason, but they are there. So this is the background part of the talk, entirely conventional Rindler space setting, and the observation is there are these correlations in time, but they are still space-like separated. And the new observation is that there is a setting in which these correlations between early and late times do become available to a single observer. And that setting, the simplest case of that setting, is a Rindler observer, a Rindler person in a half space. So we're still in Minkowski space, let's say 1 plus 1, but we put in that space a mirror. So the left-hand side doesn't exist anymore. All of my space-time is now the positive x side of Minkowski space. So to conserve probability, we need to impose some sort of boundary conditions at the mirror, and there is a family of choices. I'll be thinking of Dirichlet or Neumann. Either would work. And the nice thing about those two is that you can now work with the method of images. There is, again, a Minkowski-like vacuum in this right half space. It's not fully Lorentz invariant because there's the mirror there breaking your Lorentz invariance, but nevertheless, this is defined in terms of the preferred Minkowski time translations, and you can get its two-point function from the Minkowski two-point functions by the relevant method of images and so on. So this is a well-behaved quantum field theory. Rindler. Well, half space does have a Rindler wedge. There it is. So I want to look at a specific Robb on a uniformly accelerated world like that. And I'll again think of it as belonging to a family dragged by a local boost killing vector. And I'll make a special choice here. So I will choose the family to be such that the killing vector goes to zero exactly at that mirror. Now, we heard yesterday about a setting in which this choice is a rather special one among many that you could make. So you could have chosen this mirror to be to the left and so on. Now, I'm choosing this case because here it's easy to do the explicit calculations. I do believe that for the purposes of the time correlations that emerge from here, it would not make a qualitative difference whether the mirror is slightly to the right or slightly to the left. It would make a quantitative difference, but for the qualitative argument, I believe this is the representative case. So there is a Rindle wedge. There is now my uniformly accelerated Rob. And it's a reasonable question to ask, what does Rob see? If I think of this in terms of the Bogoliubov transformations, about the notion of particle with respect to time-like symmetry, well, for Rob, there is still exactly the same local time-like symmetry that there used to be without the mirror. There is this boost symmetry in the wedge. It doesn't, the symmetry doesn't exist in all of the space-time, but it does exist in the wedge. And within that wedge, this Rob, this whole family of Robs, can use the local boost symmetry to define their notion of particles exactly the same way they do in the full Minkowski space. So what happens? We have the vacuum. We'd like to see what it looks like when written in terms of Rob's notion of particles. And this is what it looks like. So there is again this frequency type index and this somewhat ill-defined product over those indices. But for each frequency, we now get, we now get an expression. The first thing that strikes you is there is no left and right. There can't possibly be a left and right because there is no left. There are only particles on the right. This is an excited state. There are many particles. But there are no correlations between particle here or particle there. Instead, there are only even excitation numbers in each particle mode, and they come with certain weights. Now, so the first time I saw this state was when we actually worked it out in a related gravitational context. I've since learned to appreciate that this is, in fact, a well-known state in quantum optics, and it has a name. It's called a single-mode squeezed state. Okay? But this is what the state looks like. So there are no correlations between pairs of particles when done this way. Instead, there are double occupation numbers. No? Okay, so in the paper, we had that formula in terms of a double factorial, and I worked out that coefficient the day before I prepared this talk. So if there's some error in that coefficient, I apologize. But I do believe it is a single-mode squeezed state. It does depend on the frequency. There is this exponential factor, but there is a factor of that sort as well. It's a pure state in one. It had to be because there is no two. Is there thermality? I mean, you'd still think that a uniformly accelerated observer should not care about the mirror, at least when they are too far, at least when they are far from the mirror. But when you stare at that expression, well, from that expression alone, it's not clear that there would be any thermality. Why? Well, remember, we are now using a plane wave states here. So these notions of particles, these are entirely unlocalized in time. This 2n state here thinks similarly in the distant past and in the distant future. If we wanted to see whether there's any thermality here, we would need to do it, and we will need to do it in terms of localized wave packets. And it is in that context that those that the thermality does arise. So let's do this in terms of wave packets. We use those localized wave packets. Again, feel free to pick your favorite sense of localization. But what comes out now is that the Minkowski vacuum is a product over the index that, that specifies the localizations of the modes. And now the correlations do come in pairs. Okay. So there is an excitation in a mode that I've called J plus, an excitation that I've called J minus. All of them are on the right-hand side. They have to be. And the key question is, what is the time correlation between those pairs of excitations? Well, you've seen what happens in full Minkowski space. This vacuum came by the method of images. The method of images identifies things on the left and right with a fixed value of t. This is what must happen. Right? If you have one of these particles in the far future, then the correlated pair will be in the far past and vice versa. So there are correlations now. It is a time-like correlation between the past and between the future. And notice those coefficients. They have the same form as they had in Minkowski space. There is a sense of thermality. If you take a late-time observer and say they know nothing about early times, then they see exactly the same thermality as you would see in ordinary Rindler space. In fact, the particle excitation, expectation numbers, and so on. It's identical. It's an identical late-time density matrix. Similarly, at early times, you see an identical density matrix. The correlations show up if you were to look at the correlations between early times, or if you were to go here at intermediate times where the wave packets do overlap. If you are slightly uneasy about this sense of localization, that I haven't made it very explicit, on the particle we do spell out one way. In the paper we do spell out one way to make that make that localization explicit. But if you're suspicious about these wave packets in the first place, well, the thermal response can be confirmed by a particle detector analysis. And we heard about one of those analyses in September in Spain. So there are correlations. They are now time-like correlations. And thermality comes from ignoring those time-like correlations. The question to which I don't have the answer to is, there are these time-like correlations. Could they be used as a resource for some quantum information tasks? Say, could you store some information in the quantum state over here, and then at late times, in an efficient way, recover that information? That I don't know, but this is a setting in which the question could be asked. So this is now an index that labels the wave packets. So each J, it's localized approximately in the Rindler frequency and approximately in the relevant space-time way, right? Right, so I haven't been explicit here. So given a J over here, there is a pair of particles. J plus is such that it's localized over here. J minus is such that it's localized over here. It's not just that. If you are working with massless particles, then it comes out, let me say that way. Suppose you were working with massless particles in 1+1. Then right movers and left movers separate at the outset. Okay? And then when you do this method of images, then a right mover here gets correlated with a left mover here. So that is true. But in addition, this right mover here, if I take it to be localized in time in the far future, then this left mover here is localized in time in the distant past. If you were using massive particles, well, then there are some technical subtleties in that right movers and left movers don't entirely decouple, but the basic argument is the same. So this is the showcase example, and this is perhaps the case of prime interest for this audience. How am I doing with time? Oh, Okay. So I promised to say that there are gravitational versions of this effect. Well, the Unruh effect is supposed to be a poor man's version of a similar thermal effect that occurs in a black hole spacetime, specifically on an eternal black hole spacetime. So let me talk a little bit about this, our favorite example of an eternal black hole spacetime, the Kruskal extension of Schwarzschild. Right, so there's a Schwarzschild exterior, and then you do the usual analytic extension, and you discover this spacetime. And, well, it's an eternal black hole. It's a black and white hole. It has existed since forever. It's not created in a star collapse. Okay. You might be worried that if you want to work in this eternal black hole spacetime, how relevant is it really? Well, for theorists, this is no problem. Theorists said, let's suppose that this was created in the early universe by some quantum fluctuation, perhaps, and now we have it at our disposal. If I wanted to play these mirror games and do a similar argument, I would need to say that, well, suppose this was created in the early universe, and suppose there was a mirror created in the center of the black hole at the early universe, and that would be a hard sell even for a theorist. Fortunately, you don't need to invoke mirrors. You can play with symmetries. You would like to do some sort of method of images, left and right identification here, and the key idea is that with Kruskal, you don't just have the two dimensions in the picture, you have also the spherical dimensions that are suppressed in the picture. And you can use those spherical dimensions to do an identification that identifies the left and right in this picture, and at the same time identifies antipodal points on the suppressed two-sphere. In the interest of time, let me not try to talk through the technicalities of this, but I'll assert that this can be done. It creates for you a perfectly well-behaved spacetime. When you draw the conformal diagram, it looks as if there was a mirror over there, but it's not really a mirror, it's just a wormhole throat. I'll show a picture of that in a moment. And it is again a black and white hole, so there is an initial singularity. And now, for a theorist, it is reasonable to postulate that these things might have been created in the early universe. They are still spherically symmetric in the appropriate sense. They are time-orientable. You can do quantum field theory. They are even space-orientable. You have no problem with spinners on them. They have somewhat unusual spatial topology, and that has to do with this nomenclature here and why they are called what they are called. But in the interest of time, let me not go into that. I'd like to show a snapshot of this space-like slice over here and what happens over here. So this is a space-like slice through Kruskal. There's an infinity over there. There's an infinity over there. The snapshot looks like this. So I've suppressed one dimension. So there is the wormhole throat. It's really an S2. So I've drawn it as a circle in this diagram. So when you do this left-right identification, what happens to that space-like slice? You now have only one infinity over there, and where you used to have the wormhole throat, well, now you are doing an antipodal identification on that blue two-sphere. And there is some topological terminology that you could put into this. And this fits nicely into the framework of topological geon spacetimes as introduced by Sorkin. The basic idea is that you have just one asymptotic infinity. You might have some non-trivial geometry, non-trivial topology in the center regions, but you only have one asymptotic infinity. And now on this spacetime, well, everything that I've said goes through. The analog of the Unruh effect is in a certain state called the Hartle-Hawking vacuum, the Hartle-Hawking-Israel vacuum, and the idea is that there are correlations between right and left, and someone who just looks at things on the right sees this as a thermal equilibrium state in the Hawking temperature. Now, if you go to the identified space-time, well, mirror image, you've seen what happens in Minkowski space. Exactly the same thing happens over there. And for thermality, if you look at early times or late times, you have thermality as well. You have other limits in which you have thermality, say, if you... And that has to do with the suppressed two dimensions in the picture. If you only choose to look at one angular momentum, even in the central regions, then you have thermality for them as well. But again, you have thermality, and it's created by these time-like correlations. Okay, so in the last minute or so, so that's the showcase example. There's a zoo of others, and they have their various interesting properties. I'd like to mention one, not least because two collaborators are present here. So suppose you try to put in charge here, and you'd like to play this game of mirror images with the charge. With the charge, there's a problem, and the name of the problem is Gauss's law. So take the Reissner nostrum, let's say electric Reissner nostrum. If the charge at this end is Q, the charge at this end is minus Q. If the electric field here is pointing out, the electric field here is pointing in. And if you try to do this identification, well, you are messing up with the sign of the electric field. So it doesn't work as such. If you want to make it work, you need to make charge conjugation into a gauge symmetry. I mean, charge conjugation is a symmetry of electromagnetism. We don't usually think of it as a gauge symmetry, but you can do so. So charge is now then locally still defined, but globally not defined, globally defined only up to an overall sign. And there's some technical language in which you can do this. And so if you gauge your charge conjugation, then there is a Gion version of this. And now you can do Hawking, the Hawking-Unruh effect. And if you do, the picture looks pretty much the same. There are the time-like correlations. The new thing is, how does this charge conjugation show up? And it shows up in this sign of the charge in these correlations. On the left here, the correlations are between opposite signs of charge. So if this has positive charge, this has negative charge. On the right, both members of the pair have the same charge. So if we really had a spacetime like this created in the early universe, we could observe the Hawking-Unruh effect here, and we could tell that these correlations, if these correlations are between same signs of the charge, then that would be a sign that something unusual has happened behind the horizon. Okay, so I should conclude. So I hope I've convinced you that in the Unruh effect, there are settings where there are time-like correlations. I would argue without any pathologies. And the showcase example is the uniformly accelerated observer in half space. There are correlations. They are between early and late times. And by ignoring those correlations, you see thermality. And there are black hole settings where similar things arise. And there are gauge charges of various sorts. And you can repeat similar arguments. And those correlations tell interesting things about what happens to those gauge charges. What happens to your gauge bundle behind the horizons? The question that I don't have anything to say about today is, could these correlations be used for quantum information tasks? Well, open question. Should we be able to hear something about that in a future meeting in this series? I would be delighted indeed. We might even hear about it in a meeting in Nottingham in the future. So I'll stop here. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for your talk. So questions?
So regarding your last question, a possible resource for quantum information, there is indeed a task that, for which you can use temporal correlations. If you think about the standard space-like correlations, the task is to reduce quantum communication complexity. That's the official name for that. But you can think about the task, which is not very exciting. You want to violate Bell's inequality. So you can do it classically, but you have to send some bits from one side to another. So in that sense, entanglement or space-like correlations save on classical communication, although they cannot be used for signaling, of course. Now, similarly, you can think about temporal correlations. You can think about violating corresponding, this is sometimes called Leggett-Gagg inequalities, but something which is of the same type inequalities just for measurements on a single system in time. Now, you can violate them also classically, but you need now not to send classical bits from one side to another, but to keep them from the past time point to the future. So you need some memory. And in that sense, quantum temporal correlation can save on memory.
I just want to defend what you said before. I think you really had there what is called a single mode squeeze state. Exactly. And it was already derived by Walt and Panangaden in the 70s, exactly in the same form you have it. So.
Thank you. A couple of quick questions. So basically, in Rovelli's paper, they actually claim that they have an entanglement-free derivation of the Unruh effect. So basically, the main feature that they defend is that they don't have entanglement in their states. So basically, after looking at your talk, I would say, well, there is entanglement, but just, you know, looking at the appropriate bipartition of your system, right? What do you think about that?
I would agree with you. In fact, there. Okay, so suppose I did look at a particle detector over here, and I were careful about the switching of that particle detector, and I wanted to ask, what does this particle detector see at asymptotically late times? Okay, then it turns out that for even in the asymptotically late times, it makes a difference whether the detector was switched on at a finite time or in the infinite past. And this was worked out by Paul Longley. And the point is that in the infinite future, you see the correlations that were in the distant past, and then it is crucial whether the particle detector really already was switched on the distant past or not.
I see. So, and another quick question. So nothing prevents me from doing the same decomposition in a scenario where I don't have a mirror, right? So if I mind that I don't have a mirror, I have the whole flat space-time, right? And I have Rindler observers in no mirror. So two Rindler wedges and no mirror in the middle. And I have a quantum field theory defining the whole space-time, okay? Yep. Well, nothing prevents me from doing the same thing in every single wedge, right? Or what prevents me from doing it? This kind of decomposition. So decompose the one modes into that, into distant past and distant future modes, localizing time and space. And the same in the other wedge. Is there anything that prevents me from doing that? So the same formalism that you used, but in the whole flat space-time scenario. Yeah, yeah, but then I want to, yeah, exactly. But you're considering these modes localized in the past, and you can do also the decomposition of modes one in terms of past, distant future modes and describe it like in a mirror image, right? So putting, for example, the observer in the future in two, the observer, the wave packet localization in the future in two and in the past in one, right?
Yes.
You could do that. So is it not possible then that you can play mixing time-like and space-like correlations if you have access to both wedges and detectors there? So imagine that I have, for example, I have an experiment in which I have to take advantage of these time-like correlations and also space-like correlations.
Ah, okay. So let me understand. I've here put a specific reference rob, and I've said that let that particle be observed by that reference rob. So I could change this reference rob, and then the particle might be over there and keep this reference rob as it is. And then I would see the correlation like that. So yes.
Okay. Well, that's great because that gives a lot of. If we are to use that as a quantum information resource, that gives more freedom to play with. So yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Let's thank the speakers again, and let's go on with the next.